your host, Shalina Tobin, and I'm joined by the remarkable Eduardo Pelicano. A true cosmopolitan, Eduardo presides over the fabulous Michelin-starred Mouse restaurant in Shoreditch, which has the accolade of one of London's top gastronomic experiences. Hey, Eduardo, thank you so much for your time. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm very good. Very, very good.
It's your day off today. What are you up to?
Just relaxing a little bit, had something to eat, and just enjoying a little bit of time off until we get back to it tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so excited to be joining you tomorrow. I finally got my table in.
I'm excited too. I'm very excited for you to come in.
So I think you were destined to be in hospitality, Eduardo. Your father had a restaurant where you'd spend a lot of your time as a kid. Talk to us about the influences in that period of your life.
I think I was very fortunate growing up and having... I mean, I would say, yeah, my dad definitely inspired me a lot. but I think growing up with an Italian father and a Chinese mother, both heritages, their love for food is incredible. And for me, it was something which was just so normal to grow up and to be eating all this, to be eating all this incredible food. And it played a massive part in my life. I think I feel very, very fortunate. I think a lot of kids, especially in London, aren't as exposed to good food as maybe I was when I was that age. I think going to my dad's restaurant obviously was a big thing, and hanging out with the chefs. I mean, I think at that point I didn't ever think that I was going to be a chef myself, if I'm being honest. But just being in that environment in his restaurant, surrounded by chefs, surrounded by just like the whole kind of hospitality team obviously played a big influence.
Yeah, and you mentioned obviously your parents are you know, very different, come from very different backgrounds and different cultures. Mm-hmm. Which cuisine would you say had the stronger influence on you when you were a child?
I think Chinese food. I think Asian food in general. I think, you know, even my dad, he's Italian, but he loves cooking. He loves cooking Chinese food. I spent a lot of my time kind of also traveling a lot to. I was in Singapore a lot, and then. When my parents divorced, my father, his new partner was from Japan, so I was traveling to Japan, traveling to Singapore.
Wow.
And it was that for me was really like, yeah, that was like my comfort food, you know, those kind of flavors. And it's quite interesting because I feel like that now is really showing more in our food more than ever, which is something that I've really wanted to do for such a long time. But that makes me feel happy to kind of have these nostalgic moments in the menu or memories of flavors that I had growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to delve into your menu a little bit later on. We're just going to talk about your history just for now.
Sure.
So you spent your childhood in the UK, and aged 14, you moved to Rome because you was opening a second restaurant. Was this something you found exciting, or were you nervous about it? Do you remember how you felt at the time?
I was excited. I was definitely excited. I think the idea to move to Rome is always something which is quite exciting. I wasn't doing very well in school, I think, in London as well. So I was like, yeah, maybe I could just get an easy way out here and move country. No, but I was excited to experience a different culture, a completely different culture, and I didn't really have to think twice about it.
Right. And you were there for about 4 years. So, like you said, you left school and you did actually end up working with your dad. I guess in an essence, you were like 4 years in training already and you didn't even realize it.
Yeah, I mean, I think again, being like loving food, and as I have throughout my whole childhood until I started cooking. Well, obviously I still loved it, but when I wasn't cooking, I was just eating, and I still obviously I loved it a lot. There was still no plan in my mind, no thought in my mind that from 14 to 18 that I was gonna be a chef. I still didn't have that. It wasn't a plan at all. It came just by chance. But when the chance came, it felt so right, if that makes sense. So when I was 14, when I moved to Rome, obviously I was still in school, and when I at like 18, 19, I kind of dropped out again. I was like, school was one of those things that just definitely wasn't for me. And then my dad was like, well, instead of just doing nothing all day, why don't you get inside the kitchen and do something productive? And I was like, yeah, okay, why not? I'll give it a go. And I was doing like the really basic stuff. He made me do like, yeah, it wasn't any.
What did he make you
He,
do?
I mean, I was like cleaning things, and I was like, I definitely had the commis chef job, which is right,
Yeah.
but there wasn't any like child son privileges in his restaurant. So yeah, so that was my first taste of it. And I thought like this is maybe something that I can pursue.
In so you did mention that you didn't think you would ever be a chef, but did you think that maybe you would join your dad in the business, in the restaurant business?
No, I actually didn't. No, I didn't. I saw how hard he was working, and I
Yeah.
saw how hard the people in his restaurant were working. And I'll be very, very honest to you, I was like, no, that looks too much. I was like, that looks too hard for me. I would do something a little bit easier. Turns out.
You made it a lot harder for yourself, actually.
I mean, yeah, exactly. But I think no matter what I was gonna do, I don't know. I always want to be. I always want to strive to be the best at it. So whether it's being a chef or anything else, if that's what I chose to do, I would want to put everything into it, and be as successful as possible.
Yeah. So you were 18 when you came back to the UK, and I guess you'd already gained some real-time experience working with your dad. You went on to do the diploma at Westminster Kingsway College. Was that to improve techniques or just learn basics of cooking? What was that for?
Was to learn the basics. I mean, what I was doing in my dad's restaurant in Rome was I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything. And I needed I was actually debating it. I was like, well, and I was speaking to quite a lot of, luckily my dad, he was in the food industry for we had a restaurant in London for quite a long time, and he knew quite a lot of influential people. So I was speaking to them and just asking them for their advice. Like, what do you recommend? Do you recommend that I go to school, or do you recommend that I just go start working in restaurants? And a lot of them recommended going to school. And I think it definitely was the right thing, because I had to learn the basics. I mean, it was a lot. It's quite long, the diploma. It's 3 years. I think we could have done it in two. I think it stretched it out quite a bit, but it was good fun. It was like the first kind of experience for me to like also be around people who have the same interests as me. Because I grew up in, or going to school, I don't think anybody in my school ever turned around and be like, do you know what? I want to be a chef, or had the same kind of passion for food as me. So I was quite excited by that. I was quite excited to be in a in a classroom full of people who share the same passion as I do. But to answer your question, it was to learn the basics and perfect those before going anywhere else.
Where it took you, I guess, right? So just get a feel for
Exactly. I think still at that point, I was like, yeah, okay, this is definitely what I want to do. But I didn't know what kind of, like, what style of cooking I wanted to do. I didn't know, like, what kind of restaurant I wanted to work at. I didn't know that. And I think that's what the beauty of the course does. It lets you have a feel, a little bit of everything. And then you can start to think a little bit more about what kind of direction you want to go in.
Yeah, absolutely. So from there, the direction you went in, you went to Locanda Locatelli. Did you work directly with Giorgio?
I think he came into the kitchen maybe 5 times.
Okay.
the whole time. I was there. He's obviously a huge presence. He's very, very charismatic.
Yeah.
I think he was at that point where he wasn't doing that much cooking anymore.
Okay.
It was definitely a good experience.
It was definitely a good experience. Mission Star at that time, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. It was Mission Star. And when I finished the diploma, you know, that's where my head was that I wanted to work in the best restaurants in London. That was it straight away. It wasn't my college friends, they went to work in maybe smaller places to gather a bit more experience before going into Michelin star restaurants. And there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, it was just one thing in my head was that I want to go work in the best restaurants in London, and I want to learn as quickly as I can and as much as I can and develop. As quickly as possible.
And you did actually, you say as quick as possible, and you did really, really well, because you moved to, is it, okay, sorry if I'm saying this wrong, Viajante?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Did I say it right? Oh, great, okay.
Yeah.
You quickly progressed and you became senior chef de partie within 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you weren't joking about moving quickly.
No, I wasn't, but I think also, I think Viajante changed the way I thought about food, and that is, you know, probably the most influential place that I worked in.
Could you describe how it changed your perception from
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, kitchens and restaurants, everything is always about, the chef is only as good as the team that he has. And the team that we had was incredible. It really, really was. It was just such highly talented, creative chefs. And when you're working in a group like that, that pushes you to be better. I remember when I started there, I was young. I was like 21, 22, maybe 20. Yeah, 22. I don't know. So long ago now. I was the youngest one there by a long way. Everyone else was 28. Nearly 30.
That's unusual. And
it is unusual. It definitely is. And I was so grateful to have that kind of opportunity. And it definitely was hard. It was hard to be, you know, the youngest person in the kitchen, to feel like to earn people's respect. But I worked with, there was some amazing, amazing chefs, and they really, the head chef, Leandro Carrera, he probably today he is probably the best chef I've ever worked with. He was, just an incredible mentor, and he pushed me really, really hard. And I think at the time I was like, fuck, this guy's really, he's an asshole. Sorry to swear. Maybe I'll say something else. I don't know the way to describe it.
It was tough.
Yeah. He was very, very tough with me. And at the time I was like, oh, it's because he doesn't like me. And it's like, and then I just started to understand a little bit more. It's like, no, it's because he really sees potential in me. And he wants to push me because he knows that I can go all the way, I can go further. But more than anything, he pushed me creatively, and he allowed me to work on dishes. I mean, I was like 22, 23 years old, and working where I thought at that time, and I think the restaurant name Via Gente, even if you say it now, it still holds a lot of weight. It was one of the most forward thinking gastronomic restaurants in London, and to be able to be working on dishes for that menu at that age was incredible. It filled me with so much confidence. I mean, of course, these weren't just my ideas. It was basically him telling me the idea but saying work on it. But just by doing that, it really built up my confidence. I think that's so important with young chefs now, is that I don't think enough restaurants do that. I don't think enough restaurants push the young chefs to think creatively. And when you get to that point where you become a sous chef or a head chef and you need to start creating dishes, you're a little bit stuck, you know, you're a little bit stuck. You have to the more you do something, the better you get at it. And I think overcoming, you know, designing, you know, creating a dish and putting it up for the whole team to try is such, you put yourself in a very, very vulnerable position. Mm. And you need to get used to criticism. You need to get used to people saying that doesn't work. That's you know, like this whole dish doesn't work, and almost taking all the negativity and learning how to deal with it.
Leaving the ego out the door and
absorbing
that you're told.
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard. And I remember the first dish that I did, it was not a good dish. It was really, really not. I think it was like a celeriac dessert. It wasn't that it wasn't good. It was a little bit controversial. And some people loved it, some people didn't like it. And the people that didn't like it definitely let me know that they didn't like it. And it was, I remember I used to go home and I was like, oh my God, like, don't want to do this anymore. Like, can't even make a dish. Nobody likes it. And yeah, it's about getting over that and just thinking about the next dish and then doing it. And it obviously starts to get better and better. But he really gave me that platform amongst all these incredible chefs. You know, a 22-year-old who's had 1 year's experience in an Italian restaurant. You know, for him to give me that kind of opportunity was, it built up my confidence and changed the way that I was thinking about things. But more so, I mean, in terms of the restaurant itself, as I said, it was very forward thinking. It wasn't that classical type of restaurant, which was definitely something that I didn't want to be in a classic. I didn't want to cook in a classic French restaurant. Nothing wrong with it. I love to go and eat there, but it's not my style, and it's not something that gets me excited. And at Via Gente, it was very creative, super, super, super creative. It was thinking outside the box, and that's why when I say change the way that I, you know, looked at food, it's because I was now looking through it was almost like a new pair of eyes, right, thinking outside the box, not just about a classic technique, about like an unusual combination. Why does that have to go with that? Why do we have to do this? Why do you have to do that? I really feel like being exposed to that really at a very, very young age as well, kind of set me apart from a lot of other people.
And I mean, talking about mentorship, that is, I mean, that it's so important for someone to recognize that you A, have the potential, and B, to nurture it, and for you to learn how to, you know, basically take it on and to start learning everything. I think mentorship is such a big thing in this industry between chefs. And, you know, you can either, you know, lose them really, really quickly if you don't have the right guidance. How do you lead your team, and what kind of you know, mentorship sort of lessons do you pass on?
I like to think I'm fair, and I think it's definitely something that, again, you know, through your career as a chef, before you have your own kitchen, you'll always work in places that you agree with how the leadership, how the kitchen is run, and there will be some things that you don't agree with. And there were definitely some things that I did not agree with along this journey. And I always said that when I have my own kitchen, I won't treat my staff like that. So as I said, I like to think I'm very fair. I'm also very strict at the same time. I think we have a very high standard, and I know how to work in our kitchen. You have to be very, very highly ambitious, and I know what everybody's goals are and how much they want to develop themselves. And for that reason, that's why I push them. I push everybody a lot to be better every single day and to work harder. But at the same time, they're like my family. They're like my second family. You know, they're like my brothers. And we have a very good relationship outside of the kitchen. Actually, so two of the chefs that are in my kitchen, so both the sous chefs. One is the senior sous chef, who's Danny, and we actually went to college together. So I've known Danny now for 9 years.
Oh, wow.
I've known him for 9 years. And he actually also, out of chance, worked with me at Viajante as well, or with me.
Wow.
We worked, yeah, exactly. And I remember that when we were about to open this project, we were about to open this restaurant, I wanted to bring together like the best team, but also a team that I had worked with before and knew very, very well. And Danny was obviously... I've known him for so long. He's a good friend and an incredible, incredible chef. So he was obviously on the list, and also was Warren. So Warren, I used to work with at Portland, where he started off as a commis chef, and now he's a junior sous chef. So they're still with me now. So I think that has to say something then.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm treating them well. No, but I think it's, you know, I think it's all about balance. I think it's all about balance.
Yeah.
And I think also what's quite a hard one is, especially when you're in a kitchen and you're surrounded by this team, you know, what, 16 hours a day, 4 to 5 days a week, you become very, very close to them.
Mm.
And then let's just say, you know, and then you go for drinks and days off or after work.
Mm.
And finding that balance where you can be friends, but then also their boss, is always a fine line, you know. And I always think that that's something that I really appreciate from them, because it's something that they always understand. They know when it's time to, yeah, we're all gonna have a laugh and joke, but then they know when I'm being serious and they need to crack on. So I think a balance of the two.
And you mentioned earlier on, you said that, you know, when I have my own, when I'm leading my own kitchen, I know what I'm going to pass on to my team.
Yeah.
Was that at Viajante where you knew that you wanted to lead your own kitchen at some point? Was that sort of the moment?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when I left college, I mean, I think from that point I knew. I was like, I will have my own restaurant. I will definitely have my own restaurant. And that's why I want to work in the best restaurants and gain as much knowledge as quickly as possible. At Viajante, the way that the relationship that I had and that I still have with Leo, was something that I looked at and I said, I want my chefs to have that feeling. I want my chefs to have that feeling that I have with him, you know?
Yeah. So what you did after Viajante was amazing. You went off to Copenhagen and you spent a few months with a research and development kitchen at the world famous Noma restaurants. I want to live through your experience. So talk to us about that time. Tell us, you know, what you learned and what it was like.
Yeah, I was very lucky that I was able to go there for a stage. It was only an internship. It was only 3 months. Yeah. And also, I was very lucky that, again, through Leo, he knew one of the sous chefs there. And I spent most of my time in the R&D kitchen, which was amazing. It was incredible. I think that was the time where they were just preparing to go to Tokyo. They were bringing Noma to Tokyo. So I could see a lot of the things that they were working on, and it was incredible experience. I think what I learned the most, I didn't necessarily walk away with, and I always say this to like interns or stagiaires that come to our restaurant, is that you can come with like a notepad and you can write down all the recipes and, you know, whatever, but you're never going to really understand why we do those things. Just because you have a recipe might mean that you can make something, but there's so much more to the restaurant and a reason why, and the vision behind it of why we make things like this, that recipes actually, they don't really matter. I don't think I walked away with one recipe from Noma. I think what I took away from it and what I learned the most was, obviously, being surrounded by the best, some of the best chefs in the world, and watching how they ran such a it's quite a big organization in a way. I mean, they had nearly 35 interns when I was there, and the way that they would manage them, like the logistics of this kind of operation, is a big thing. It's a huge thing. And kind of just take a step back and look at that was really an eye opener. Obviously the standard, the standard of anything that left the kitchen was the highest. It had to be the highest. So I think you're exposed to another level of pressure. It's another level of pressure that I'd never really felt before. You know, it was, I was talking about the pressure of, being at Viajante, obviously at such a young age, and, working on these new dishes, and there's a pressure to bring your dish up and to show to the guests. But now is another pressure. You're basically cooking and serving in the best restaurant in the world. So it has to be, everything has to be perfect. And yeah, it was a lot. It was definitely a lot. It was definitely a lot to take in, but definitely made me stronger. Definitely made me into a stronger chef. And I kind of, they do this thing at Noma called Saturday night projects. Once a week, where whether it's a chef that works there or it's an intern, they pick, I think, like 8 chefs, and then they all create their own dish, and they bring it up for all the chefs to try. And everyone, like not everybody, but most of the senior chefs say their opinion on the dish. And I think that was like, I don't think I've ever been so nervous to put something up, but it was something that I had to do. It was something that I had to do. You don't have to do it. You have a choice of whether you want to do it. You put yourself forward. But I knew that was definitely, I knew it was going to be incredibly nerve-wracking and very, very scary. But I was like, there's no way that I'm going to leave. There's no way they're going to leave Noma without doing my little Saturday night project. And yeah, and doing that was already, yeah, I kind of feel like if you can serve your little dish up to the best chefs in the world, then you could do anything, right?
And what did they say about it?
Again, it was slightly controversial, as most of the things I do are. But it was thoughtful. It was actually something that I wanted to do something. I mean, like, I wanted to try to do something that not they hadn't done before, but something that was a little bit different. Mm. And I mean, try to do something that Noma hasn't done is like there's a lot of things they have done. And it was something like I wanted to make like a fresh cheese. So I made like a fresh goat's cheese, and then there was like a lot of different kind of textures, fermentations of pumpkin grilled flavors, and yeah, it was also very. It was quite a bold dish to put up, because it wasn't screaming a lot of things. It was quite it's quite delicate. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could say it's quite simple. 2-3 things on a plate, which is how I like to cook. But everybody, whether it was positive or negative, the feedback, everyone was very curious how I got like a certain flavor into the pumpkin that they hadn't seen before. And for me, that was like, okay, cool. That's pretty. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, that's pretty amazing. So yeah, I felt pretty good after that.
And did you share your secret?
Yeah, I did. No, of course. Yeah. It wasn't really a big secret. I think it was a bit more of just like a bit of luck. sometimes that, A lot of times that happens in cooking. You're just doing something. You're cooking something. You're feeling something, and it just happens, and it's just right. It just works. Mm. And I think that was just one of those kind of moments. I promise you, there's a lot of times where it doesn't work.
Well, I'll find out tomorrow. I'll let you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So, were you working closely with Renee? Do you have like a fond standout memory that you can share with us?
I don't think Renee was in the kitchen that much. I think he was more in the research development kitchen than the main kitchen. And so when you're there, all the interns take it in turns to cook staff meal or family meal for a week, which again is like, you know, you're cooking for the. I take that very seriously. Like, I take that very seriously, and as do all the chefs that work with me as well. We all know that cooking for your team is such a big thing. It's not just whack something up. You get judged every single time you put something out on the table for your team to eat, as you should, because that represents you, you know. And me and a friend of mine, we did the staff meal for a week. And I remember him coming to me and just being like, wow, this one's really, really good. Like, you guys did an amazing, amazing job with that. And he said that quite a few times for our staff meals, and that was awesome. Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
That was pretty awesome.
So I would say, yeah.
What was
I would say that
he said was in particular was really good.
We made pork buns, pork belly bao buns. Mm-hmm. So we like steamed the buns, we braised the pork belly. I mean, you have the whole day to cook two meals. It was like these pork belly bao buns, and yeah, he was happy. Thumbs up. And the other one was what else was there? There was I can't remember. Oh, I think we did something like beef and bone marrow dripping on toast or something like that. But there were a few in there. We took it very, very seriously.
I bet. How awesome. Renee loved
yeah. it. Yeah.
So you came back to London and you went to work at Portland, where you became head chef within a year, and you were able to like express any of the techniques that you had picked up from Noma, or did you keep them a bit of a secret?
I mean, I think as I was saying, like I didn't leave Noma with like a handful of recipes. I mean, I think one thing that was always very Yeah, techniques, exactly. I think one thing which was always very, very interesting to me was like fermentation. And that's obviously something at Noma, which is a huge part of what they do and their philosophy. And I spent a couple of weeks in the fermentation lab with one of the guys there. And I was really, really intrigued by it. The kombuchas, you know, the lactic fermentations, there were so many things. And yes, I definitely did. Like when I came to Portland, that's definitely something that I wanted to show was and express was a little bit of those kind of those techniques, as you said, a little bit of those fermentations, pickling. So yeah, I mean, obviously Portland was a very, very different style to anything I had worked in before, but it felt right also, you know, it felt right because it was, I think when you're working in a lot of these, when you're working in a lot of fine dining, tasting menu, creative restaurants, sometimes you don't actually cook that much, you know, you don't actually cook that much. And when I say cook, I mean like, you know, like, you know, cook a piece of meat in a pan, sear it, baste it, and actually cook it. A lot of it is so precise, and you know, you have to be so consistent that a lot of it is like, sometimes it's like you sear something, you put it in the oven, and then it comes out and it's perfect. Mm-hmm. And I think after kind of Viajante and then also going to Noma for a stage where everything was obviously super, super creative and like unusual, mm-hmm. I was like, I just want to like cook now. I just want to like go a little bit back and just start cooking and making like really tasty food. Not saying that Noma's not tasty, not saying that Viajante's not tasty, but I think you know what I mean. A little bit more less weird. less funky and a bit more
pork barbuns.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Yeah. More poor barbuns. Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, go on.
No. I said that's why I kind of made that choice, because for me, I kind of felt like already at that point, I was saying to myself, you know, when I have my own restaurant, when I have my own kitchen, the kind of food that I want to cook, I want it to be a mixture of the two. Like, I want it to be creative and unique and unusual. I want it to be tasty. I also want it to be tasty. And I think sometimes those things can get forgotten in, you know, those kind of tasting menu restaurants.
Yeah, sometimes it can be, you know, it can look really good, but you're not expecting mm-hmm. the flavors to be what they are.
Exactly.
I totally agree with you. How was your first role of head chef? Because this is your first head role chef, wasn't it, at Portland?
It was my first head role. Yeah, it was amazing. It was really good. I learned a lot. I think obviously working with Merlin was amazing. And I learned a lot. Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. There was a lot of mistakes that I made. There's definitely a lot of mistakes that I made that you know, I look back on it now and I was like, what an idiot. What an idiot. But I was also very young. I was like 24, 25. Yeah. You know, I was just extremely, extremely young, and to have a head chef job at that time, it can get to your head a little bit. It gets to your head a little bit. And I learned a lot. It was amazing to have the opportunity. I mean, to be head chef in a Michelin star restaurant at 25 is
awesome.
Is awesome, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like I said, there was definitely, I think I had a chance to be a lot more creative there. And maybe that was the first time I could start to really work on more dishes myself. Mm. And but again, in the back of my head, I was always thinking, I was like, yeah, but this is also not the food that I would want to have at my restaurant, you know. And when I have my restaurant, when I have my kitchen, it will be a combination and a mixture of a lot of things. I think when you talk about let's say when you're speaking about how I lead the team or the management of the team, I think that's a good example, because that was, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes when you're a very young head chef, like I said, sometimes it can get to your head a little bit, and you stop. Inspiring people, and it just becomes about like yelling at people and telling them what to do, and just it can get forgotten, it can get lost quite quickly. And that was something that I kind of regret that a little bit. Kind of regret maybe not inspiring the team as much as I should have at some point.
There's a learning curve for you as well. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the whole point, right? That's what growth is all about. So let's talk about Mouse. And you know, you started there 2018, like mm-hmm. 3 years ago now. Must have been such an exciting time for you. It's a brand new restaurant, and you've played a really integral role in its growth and evolution. Talk us through mm-hmm. the beginning stages. How did they find you, or did you apply? Mm-hmm. How did it work? Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, so obviously I worked with I worked for Nuno at Via Gianto, and we stayed in touch for quite a while. And at that point, when I was at Portland, it's just something that we were speaking about, that he was about to start a new project, and asked if I wanted to be the head chef there. And I didn't have a lot to think about, really. Sounded amazing. And it was amazing.
I know the owner of Blue Mountain School is James Brown. Did he have the initial vision for a Michelin-starred restaurant, or did the concept start mm-hmm. very simply, just a very simple restaurant?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a really good question, actually. And I think we all underestimated what... I don't think we ever thought that this is what it was gonna be, the level of what it was gonna be. It was supposed to, originally the idea was supposed to be a very small, intimate dining experience, even smaller than what it is now, because it is still very small and intimate. I think initially we were talking eight, nine guests.
Wow.
Maximum. Yeah. I think there wasn't even a KP area. And then slowly it went up from 8 to 9, then it went to 12, and then it went to 16. And then when we first opened, we opened with a communal table, and it was 16 guests could sit around the table, and the experience that we wanted to offer was an experience where you could almost feel like you are walking into our home a little bit. You can have the freedom to move around during the meal, which is always something that I don't know, I kind of felt that when you go to these Michelin star tasting menu dinners, which you'll see tomorrow night, it's quite long. But sometimes it's quite like you sit down in that same space for like 3 hours, 4 hours, and it's a little bit, I don't know, I feel that sometimes, just like, that's a bit boring now. Like, I kind of want to just get up and, like, I don't know, move. I've been sitting in this chair for, like, yeah, like, exactly like I'm saying, 3 to 4 hours. The thought of, like, being able to, like, stand up, walk to the kitchen, speak to the chefs, go to the wine room, choose a wine, to create movement in a meal was something that we felt was very, very important.
And I guess interaction as well, because you had a lot of you would encourage people to, to chat to you guys and ask questions and, roam around the kitchen and stuff.
And that's what I think is, I think maybe as chefs or restaurateurs, I don't know, we kind of, I think sometimes you underestimate the power of interaction and what that does for somebody's experience. You know, for me, I feel like you know, you can go somewhere and like food can be amazing, and do you know what, like the service was, the waiters were really, really attentive. But having that interaction or that connection with the chef or one of the chefs or something, where you feel special, and you want to feel that special again, and that's why you come back to that restaurant. It's not just for the food, it's not just for the wine list, but it's to have that, interaction, have that moment that you had with one of the staff. And yeah, and that's what we were, that's what we pushed to do, and that's what we want to do. You know, I think it's also, I also think when you say to people, come into the kitchen, or you know, when you have, or when you have no choice and you're sitting at a counter seat in front of a kitchen, I always kind of wonder a little bit, what's the point of doing that if you don't engage? Like, what's the point of putting me this close to you if we don't even like acknowledge you? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, we don't even acknowledge me here, or you don't even say a word to me. What's the point of putting me here? Is it just to watch? Is it just to watch you grill a fish? Because it's cool, but I kind of want more. I want more than that. So yeah, I think it's to make it meaningful, to make it meaningful also, you know, and genuine. Like, we genuinely want to talk to you.
And how are you managing the interaction now? Obviously, it's, we're living in very, very different times. How are you guys managing that sort of level of interaction?
I mean, after the first lockdown, I mean, we've changed the concept of the restaurant. Feels like we've opened three restaurants in the last 4 years. That's what it feels like. After the first lockdown, we took away the communal table, but that was actually something that me and James were talking about for a very, very long time. It was, we kind of wanted to move away from the communal table, but we didn't really get around to doing it. And then obviously when COVID happened, we were like, well, right, now we definitely have to do it. And so then the communal tables became individual tables. And then obviously we were thinking, well, now they can't come into the kitchen. So what are we going to do? That's like a whole experience. So we decided to bring almost like a kitchen counter into the dining room, where we could plate some dishes in front of the guests, just so they could feel like there was action happening around them. And yeah, so that was the first thing. But obviously, by doing that, you know, one of the benefits of having one big table is that you can sit a lot more people around it. So now 16, we went from 16 down to 9. How are we gonna fit, you know, how are we gonna fit another 6 to 7? So James had this idea that one of the other rooms in the building, which actually was next to the kitchen, that we would knock a hole in the wall and create like this chef's table room. So that's what we did. We knocked a hole in the wall, agree. The chef's table room. Bear in mind, this is all happening with like, we've got like 2 months to like figure this out. It's pretty like, it's pretty hectic. You got to go fast because you need to reopen. So yeah, so that's what we did. We created a chef's table room, made individual tables, and yeah, and then after the second lockdown, we changed it all again. We stopped doing the chef's table room. So yeah, we had to adapt quite a lot. But in terms of interaction, which is I think what your initial question was, after being in the first lockdown and reopening, I kind of could feel the guests wanted to come into the kitchen. They still wanted to come in, you know? And of course you need to do what's right. And at that time, I don't think it was right to start bringing them back in. But I think now what we do is we try to find a middle ground. I still think it's a huge thing. And part of what we do is our identity is to have guests in the kitchen and serve things in there and have that interaction. That if we don't have that, then I feel like we're losing a lot. So we just have to do it in a bit more of a controlled way.
Right.
It's not like, you know, when we had Mausch, let's just call it Mausch 1.0, you could walk in whenever you want. And there were like 9 guests in the kitchen, 10 guests in the kitchen. And I remember just like looking around to the chefs and being like, this is madness. This is crazy. You're like looking around, there's just guests everywhere. They're like on the walls and they're like, and I was like, yeah, I mean, let's stop doing this for sure.
You have to have a lot of concentration. Like you have to keep your concentration levels kind of up there because you've got people adding to you and you still got to prepare food. I don't know how.
That's exactly it. you'll be telling somebody your life story, and then you have to go on 16 lobsters, and it's like trying to like work this out.
Yeah.
Actually, quite a funny story. When we used to have this madness of 16 guests in the kitchen at once.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're all standing around the kitchen. You can't really keep track of where everybody is. And I remember there was this moment where there were loads of guests in the kitchen. Then they went out of the kitchen, and then I think like it was like maybe 2 courses later. I think 15 minutes later, like looked at the oven, and the oven was on 280 degrees. I was like, no, we. So just so you understand, we keep our oven at 48 degrees. So it's like 280 degrees. And so what happened was that a guest leant on the oven, turned it up to 280 degrees, and burnt all the food inside it.
Oh, no.
All the lobsters, all the Wagyu beef, all the fish. And then we're all looking at each other and like, oh, shit, this is bad.
So you had to start all over again?
We had to start it again.
Oh, no.
So I kind of, yeah. And it was kind of like, and I remember, I think I came out and I made a little joke to some of the guests and said, you know, like, you have to wait a little bit for that next course because that lady leant on the oven and she turned up to 280 degrees. But it just became something where, we had to become very much aware of it. You know, whenever guests came into the kitchen, like you said, how do you talk, focus on food, make sure that somebody's not like, you know, like got a blowtorch in their hand and like lighting their hair on fire. You know, like how do you do that? So I think regardless of COVID, I think the way that we deal with it now is a much better way. You know, you come in as maybe like there's only 2 groups of 2 in at a time. Mm. You can see everyone. Mm. And that's the right way to do it. And I think it's a bit more of a respectful way for the chefs and for the staff. You know, there used to be some guests. It used to basically just turn into like a big party. That's what it used to turn into. And it's not the guests' fault. I mean, we're sitting everybody on this table, everyone's drinking good wine, having good food. You want to have fun. But sometimes guests would like, they would just be like, oh, you know, can we just, can we eat this course like on the staircase? I'd be like, no, no, you can't. Go sit down. What do you mean, can I eat on the staircase?
There's still, I guess, there's still a level of, you know, I guess, control that you've got to maintain to keep that sort
exactly.
of experience there. Otherwise, you know, it kind of, I think, goes out the window a little bit, or out the roof, because you've actually started doing something on the roof, right? Tell us about that.
So we actually, we're not doing anything on the roof anymore.
Oh, okay, all right.
This was another one of ideas after the first lockdown. Mm. And it was that, you know, we wanted to start doing like a tea ceremony on the roof. But it just, I think also you have to, you can have a great idea. We can all have great ideas, but making them, like actually implementing them and the logistics of doing them to the level that you want to do it is another thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it'd be great. You know, another idea that we had was like, oh, you know, all the guests can eat their dinner, and then we'll take them all upstairs to the roof. Mm. It's like, how are we going to move all these people? And the tea ceremony was another thing. It's an amazing thing. And, you know, after the first lockdown, Genevieve, who's like our R&D chef / tea sommelier, she's absolutely amazing. She joined the team, and it kind of made sense that with her tea knowledge that we do something on the roof. It just logistically didn't work. It just logistically, we just couldn't do it. Mm. So, yeah, sorry to answer the question like that.
That's all right. I was looking forward to going up on the roof tomorrow, but it's all right.
Exactly.
Do you still have the tea library though? Is the library still part of the plan?
I think it will come back. I think that's where we want to be. We want to be in a position where we can have a tea library and a tea room and do that. Mm. But I don't know, me and James kind of felt that we need to streamline things as much as possible. Mm. With this reopening. Mm-hmm. I think we tried to take on a little bit too much after the first lockdown. You know, we wanted to do a lot of things, and it was too much. And I think we need to first and foremost get the restaurant. We had to get the restaurant back running, create an amazing menu, amazing service, perfect that, and then start to think about how can we bring back the tea.
Right. So yeah. I'm going to take you back a little bit to the beginning again, mm-hmm. when you first started. So I just want to talk about how the menu kind of evolved at Mouse. And the exec mm-hmm. chef at the time when you started was Nuno, as you mentioned earlier mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. So how much of a collaboration was it between you guys on the menu?
Yeah, it was a big collaboration. It was. It definitely was. And I think I had a lot of fun working on Nuno with the dishes, and it was a good time. I think what's important is that the dishes are, it represents the whole team. It's not just about like one individual, two individuals. And that's something which is quite important to us as well. I want to involve everybody in that kind of process, right? Yeah. That's what I was saying to you before when I used to work at Viajante, and that's something that made such a difference to me as a chef. So yeah, the food has definitely evolved a lot. It's changed a lot. Mm. I think when we first opened, we were doing something like 18 courses. It was 18 courses. And 18 courses. And I don't know, I think sometimes as a chef, you think that more is more, you know, more courses means better experience. And I think gradually I kind of felt like it wasn't. I kind of felt like it's very, very hard to be very consistent when you have so many courses. I mean, it's a different thing if we look at a restaurant, you know, the size of a Noma, who has 35 interns and 25 chefs or whatever it is, I don't know what it is, that you can cope with that. But when you're talking about four chefs doing 18 courses, it's very hard to get that consistent. But I think obviously what has changed a lot more now, and I think we touched on that at the beginning, is that I think I always wanted to bring in a lot more of a stronger Asian influence into our menu. And that's been, that's probably been a big change. We've gone from 18 courses now down to 11 courses, which I think is right. It was the right thing to do. And what's been amazing about the menu that you're going to have tomorrow is that the whole team worked on that menu. So it was myself, the R&D chef, Genevieve, Warren, Danny, Martin. We spent 2.5 months researching and developing this menu. And really there's been, that's probably one of the most satisfying things, I think, seeing that develop in my career to date, you know, like standing there with the whole team from 2.5 months ago, where we were scribbling things down and writing things on the windows. But just knowing that we all did this together was such a big thing for me.
Amazing.
I can't wait for you to see it tomorrow. Try it tomorrow.
I can't wait. Literally, so excited. So tell us about your Michelin star moment. You guys got a Michelin star within a year of opening. Tell us about the moment you found out.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really amazing. It was something that I was very, very happy for the whole team. Something that we worked so hard on. And it was also, we did it our way, in our own way. It wasn't done in a way which was like ticking boxes to, you know, we were like, our restaurant was like, not anti-Michelin, but it's a communal table, 16 guests. You can walk into the kitchen, you can eat anywhere you want. Like, that's so not Michelin. And to get awarded whilst doing something that we actually believe in and doing something so unique, it meant so much more. It meant so much. And we definitely celebrated it for a couple of days.
Well, definitely deserve it, for sure. Were you guys expecting it, though? I mean, did you think, you know, fair enough, the style isn't very Michelin, but did you think that the food was 100% Michelin?
Yeah, I did. Without being arrogant, yeah, I definitely did. I think we deserved it. Yeah, I think we all believe that. We all believe that we deserve to get a star. Amazing.
I think that's great. I mean, you have conviction behind, you know, behind your restaurant. I think that's amazing. Nuno left in 2020. How was the transition for you becoming executive chef? And did it, I mean, obviously, it sounds like it just flowed really naturally because you knew what kind of changes you wanted to make. You've got the more Asian influences in there. But as a role, how was that transition for you?
Yeah, it's a lot more responsibility for sure. I have to start looking at the overall picture rather than just the kitchen. So that was a big transition for that for sure. Responsibility, you know, even if, you know, there's a lot of restaurants where someone's the head chef and someone's the executive chef, and the executive chef's not there that much, so the head chef is basically running the place. But there's still a difference. You know, you can still run a place, but it's not your, you know, let's just say it's not your name.
Yeah.
And you don't have, if something goes wrong, it's on that person's head. It's not really on your head. So I think in those terms, there was definitely a lot more pressure, a lot more responsibility. And again, yeah, had to develop and learn more.
Well, It sounds like you've done incredibly well and in such a short amount of time, Eduardo. I think it's absolutely
Thank you.
brilliant because most chefs at your level now probably started when they were kids. They had mums and dads who were chefs and cooking, and they grew up with it. So it's so brilliant. Your journey is phenomenal, and how quickly
Thank you.
you managed to do it. So you're obviously making a big mark with Mouse, making it your own. What other so you're actually just focusing on the menu now, and then you're gonna perhaps bring back the tea library. What other things do you think that you have as, that you're feeling ambitious about? Do you ever think that one day you'll have your own restaurant? Or do you think of Mouse as yours?
I do think of Marsh as mine. I do. And I think that's, I'm just fully focused on Marsh right now. And I think, especially with everything that's happened in the last year and a half, we need to get this back running smoothly. And there's still room for growth there. There's still room to be better. And then maybe we can start to think about something else. But I think for now, just fully focused in Mouche. Yeah, the tea. Yeah, obviously the tea. Yeah, let's nail that. Let's nail those first.
Yeah,
Let's see.
let's do it. Just quickly about your menu, I just wanted to go a little bit more into depth about that. I know you don't like to define your style of food too much, but if you can describe the current menu, the flavors, and what we can expect at Mouse.
I think you can expect different for sure. And I think there's a lot of Asian influences in our menu, which have been created in or researched and developed in a way which is not in a commercial way. It's not in a commercial way. It's there's history to what we're doing. So I would definitely describe it as Asian influence. I think we always use as much local as local produce as possible. And yeah, creative Asian influence. Local produce. I don't know. Maybe after tomorrow, maybe you can tell me a better, a better line to describe it.
Okay, all right, I'll think about it. And you have a drinks pairing as well. How involved are you in that process of pairing the drinks with the food?
We have yeah. So we have a wine pairing. We have a non-alcoholic pairing, Yeah, I think between obviously this is the sommelier's job to match the wines with the food, but I think what's really nice is that we do have a kind of a relationship where, I want him and the restaurant manager to try as much of the food as possible, and I think vice versa. I think when there's a new wine on a new wine or a drink on the pairing, they will bring it to me and we taste it with the food together. So I think that's quite nice. It is really nice. It's really nice to have that. I think with the non-alcoholic pairing is definitely something which has really taken off, and that really is down to the amazing work that Genevieve does. I think, yeah, I think you should definitely. I don't know, are you drinking tomorrow
I drink any night.
night? Definitely want you to try some of the non-alcoholic pairings tomorrow for sure. There's I think yeah, as I said, I think Genevieve has done an amazing job with these. I think it's almost like I don't know, but like anything as well, I think anything that we do or we want to take on, I think we always want to be the best at it. Or if we're gonna do a non-alcoholic pairing, we want it to be the best in London. It's not just to do it to, because there's good margins on juice. It's to do it with meaning, like make it meaningful, put the research in, make it pair well. And I think the non-alcoholic pairing is so much more, not so much more, but it's, you know, with a wine pairing, you're buying wines, you're tasting wines, and you match it with the food. The non-alcoholic pairing, what Genevieve is doing, she is creating a flavor that matches the food, you know? So I think that's, to get that right is very, very hard. It's not just, you know, I think maybe some people think it's just like, yeah, juice a carrot, juice an apple.
Yeah.
But it's levels to it, you know, the fermentations and the acidities, the bitterness, the sweetness. There's a lot that goes into it.
And does that all happen on the premises? Does that happen there?
It does.
It's all made there.
It's all made in house.
Wow.
All made in house. Yeah. I mean, and that's why we do say to, you know, that's why we do say to guests that if you want the full pairing, you know, give us a couple of days notice, because a lot of our juices, they're live fermentations. So that means you need to feed the fermentation, otherwise it dies. So if no one's ordering it, then you don't just keep feeding it and spending more money on it just to then not sell it. So when somebody takes this juice pairing, it's being made especially for them for that night. So there's so much energy and thought and that goes into making that pairing for the guests that evening.
And
yeah, as you said, everything's been on site.
How popular is it? I mean, what's the ratio of guests that go for the non-alcoholic pairing?
I mean, I think it's always gonna swing more towards alcohol than not. But I would say maybe we average 2 to 3 pairings a night out of 14, 15, which is not bad. And some people just don't even take a pairing. So two to three is pretty good. Some nights you have like, I think tomorrow we have like 5 already. So so it's, I mean, also something for me that, you know, I always kind of felt that even when we were introducing this non-alcoholic pairing was that, I don't know, sometimes, a lot of times when I go out to eat at these tasting menu restaurants and you take the wine flight, I just get absolutely smashed. I'm so drunk by like, you know, maybe my tolerance is not as high, but I just get really drunk like halfway through the meal. and then I can't really remember the rest of the meal.
Right.
And I'm just like, and then the next day I'm just like, oh, do you know what? I really wish I didn't drink that much.
Yeah.
And something that we do, which I think is a way that I think is such a nice way to experience it, is to have like the half alcohol and non-alcohol pairing. You can have a mixture of the two.
Right.
You know, you can have your couple, you can have your glasses of wine, but then it's also nice to just like on some courses to have just a really nice kombucha, you know, really, really nice kefir or a juice. It's just really nice to have that sometimes. It breaks it up a little bit.
I have one last question for you. Tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
I love donuts a lot.
I love donuts a lot.
I do like the crosstown donuts. I do like them. I think it depends. It depends on what kind of mood I'm in. Sometimes I'm in a Krispy Kreme mood. Sometimes I'm in a crosstown mood. But I would average maybe something like a dozen donuts on my day off.
No, a dozen.
A dozen donuts on my day off.
Yeah. You really do love donuts.
I do love them. Yeah, you wouldn't know that. That's funny you say that. I've made them, but I haven't made them recently. Maybe that's something that I should maybe look into more. giving all my money to Crosstown. I love like the variety that I think Crosstown do a good job. I mean, there's a lot of other donuts in London. I could probably list them more, but it's my guilty pleasure.
Yeah, well, if you're going to be bad, then do it really well. So Crosstown,
exactly.
Cream, yeah.
Exactly, Crosstown Krispy Kreme, and then you just eat salmon and rice for the next 5 days. That's what I do.
Well, you're lucky you can still do the rice because I'm off carbs at the moment. So.
Oh.
Apart from tomorrow, my exception is
tomorrow. I was going to say. A big bowl of rice for you tomorrow and champagne. champagne and rice.
Can't wait. Really looking forward to it. Eddie, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure
chatting
with you today and getting to know you better. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Yeah, see you tomorrow. And guys, if you want to follow Eduardo, he's on Instagram at Eduardo Pelicano. And I'm at Posh Nosh Gal. If you guys enjoyed today's interview, please rate, review and subscribe. It helps other people find me.